Okay, we are in session. In attendance are Representative Lynn, Representative Grunberg is here and not here, Representative Herron, Representative Ramirez, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Holmes, Representative Gatto. First, we're going to take up Senate Bill 284 from yesterday. Public testimony is closed. We've been through the amendment process. Are there any final remarks by committee members? Seeing none, the chair will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you very much for considering moving this bill. I think it's a very, very important bill because it affects every one of us, running for re-election, perhaps to the State House. It could affect you, of course, running for your election. But I think more importantly than any of us, it affects the people of Alaska. That's what's really important, because they need to know who are funding these types of campaign pronouncements. And so, to me, the importance of the bill, although it affects you and me as candidates, I think more so it affects the people of Alaska, so they have the disclosure they need to make intelligent choices. So I'm very happy that we're going to pass the bill.
Thank you. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the chairman hearing the bill. Still have concerns, and I guess I was inarticulate in expressing my concerns about the difference between a 30-second audio ad and a 60-second audio ad, but I will reserve my vote for the floor.
Thank you. The chair will entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dahlstrom. I wish to make the motion to move CS for Senate Bill number 284, version / P, as in Peterson, with amendments, both conceptual and written, attached physical note and individual recommendations.
Thank you. Seeing no objection, the bill moves from committee. Thank you. While we're signing that packet, we are now going to move to Senator Stedman, Senate Bill 244. Darwin is here. Darwin, are you going to take us through the bill? Pleasure to have you here. You introduce yourself, put your name on the record. Thank you, Cindy, for all your help. We appreciate it. Patty Ware, if you're gone, thank you very much. Representative Grunberg has joined us. Darwin, we're delighted to have you here. Truly an honor. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Stedman. And thank you for scheduling Senate Bill 244 for a hearing in your committee. The legislation codifies in statute the legislature's intent that the state capitol is the governor's official duty station. Except for the governor and the lieutenant governor, all state employees in the administration have a designated duty station assigned by the Office of Management and Budget. It's up to the legislature, if they so choose, to designate the governor's duty station in statute. Senate Bill 244 makes that policy statement. It specifies that the governor's duty station, defined as the location where the governor spends the major portion of time assigned to fulfill the duties of office, is considered to be the state capital. Nothing in this bill is intended to alter the ability of the governor to maintain his own travel schedule at his discretion in order to execute his responsibilities. This legislation won't change the existing policies of our current governor, but it will certainly set the policy for future governors to make the state capital their duty station. That's a brief overview of the legislation, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it make more sense to say the governor must declare at the beginning of his each year his duty station, rather than us to determine his duty station?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, it would eviscerate the intent of the legislation to allow the governor to declare his or her own duty station at the beginning of every year. If the legislature's intent is to establish the policy and statute that the state capitol is the governor's duty station, then wherever the state capitol is would be the governor's duty station.
Follow-up. Do we know in a given year, let's pick a governor, where any governor, and you pick one, spends the majority of his time? Is it in the Capitol? We're here 3 months and 9 months to go. We don't know where the governor is, except usually if we call him or watch in the news, he's not here, might be in the biggest city. Do we know how much of time is spent at the moment? And
through the chair, Representative Gatto, I believe This issue has been addressed in previous committees. Kevin Brooks from the department, I've discussed with him the fact that the governor does spend a large portion of his time here in Juneau, since this is where the residence is, if provided for him by the people of the state. But this legislation wouldn't do anything to change how much time the governor can spend outside of Juneau. Obviously, we understand that the governor has many responsibilities all over the state. Juneau, the state capital, the governor's mansion, is the governor's home during his term of office. So when the governor is not traveling, the governor would turn to Juneau and live in the mansion, as this current governor does.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gatto.
And if he doesn't?
If he doesn't, through the chair, I've discussed this with legislative legal, and basically they've said that if the governor chooses not to reside in Juneau, even though the legislature has made that statement of policy and statute, that an ethics complaint could be initiated against the governor. That's the worst thing that could happen to the governor, but according to legislative legal, such a complaint would be without merit. So we don't anticipate that anything would happen to the governor if he chose not to abide by the legislative policy. But more importantly, Representative Gatto, I think that this legislation would make it easier for the governor's administrative services director to calculate his reimbursements and his travel, knowing that Juneau is the state capital, in this case Juneau, is the governor's duty station. And so that would be a clearer way for them to calculate the governor's reimbursements.
Can I just take a brief at ease for a second? Just sign that for me, please. Also available for questions is our friend Deputy Commissioner Kevin Brooks, is here from the Department of Administration. Representative Gatto, you have more questions?
One more. Consequences are simply no more than an ethics complaint. The governor spends his time, I don't even know where his house is. Is it in Anchorage?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I believe so, yes.
So if he spends 6 months in Anchorage, he gets no food per diems. And that's about the end of it.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, actually, no, that's not correct. If the governor chose to reside in his own home in Anchorage, even though the state capital being Juneau is the governor's duty station, the governor could, if he so choose, apply for meals and incidental expenses at the rate of $60 a day, but that would require an actual submission to the administrative services director. So it's up to the governor. This legislation does not remove the governor's ability to apply for meals and incidentals when he is away from his duty station. We think that the governor is living here in Juneau in the mansion and is home in Anchorage and has a personal residence available to him. He should be able to stay in that residence. It would save the state money by not paying for a hotel. And if the governor is living here and he has a house in Anchorage, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's food in his pantry, and he would still probably have to go out and buy food while he's in Anchorage.
Thank you. And for the benefit of the committee, I saw the governor at lunch today. He had a wrap, so spinach tortilla, chicken, and clam chowder. And he looks good. He's not missing meals. He looks healthy and well and for the good of the state. Any more questions, Representative Gatto? Thank you. Darwin, question. Does the bill sponsor prefer the word state capital or Juneau in the title and in subsequent language?
Representative Gatto, if I may be allowed a moment of levity, I did run this by Senator Stedman after the last committee hearing when that change was made. He said he would prefer that the state capital be in Sitka, but he lost that fight a long time ago, and so the capital is Juneau. He would prefer the legislation to say Juneau, just because that is our state capital, and it would be his intention to see Juneau remain the state's capital. But he has no objection as far as concurrence is concerned with the change to state capital.
Okay, so I'll do that. Representative Grunberg?
Yeah, I wonder how you would feel about changing it to Mountain View.
I would object.
Me too.
Go with the governor.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for the bill sponsor, for Darwin? Any questions for Deputy Commissioner Banks? Is there anybody online who wishes to testify? Anybody in the room who wishes to testify? Okay, we're going to close public testimony. We'll bring it back to the committee. Representative Lynn, you have amendment number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment number one was to make the duty station of the lieutenant governor the same as the governor would be the capital city and so on. And I think that has some merit. I understand by talking to the sponsor's representative that there's already some consideration being given.
Representative Lynn, do you move amendment number one?
I move the amendment.
I'll object for the purposes of discussion.
Okay, and I'll continue where I left off. Thank you. Understand there is some discussion about providing a residence for the lieutenant governor in Juneau, and that could possibly, one of the possibilities would be to refurbish the Wickersham house or something. I think in that the lieutenant governor could become the governor at any time. It might be an appropriate thing to think about, but with that said, I think it's a good idea to have both, but I'm not going to offer the amendment at this time because of the lateness of the season here, and I don't want to delay things any further. We've been delayed long enough in other matters. Thank you.
So amendment number one is withdrawn. I'll move conceptual amendment number two on line two, page one, is a conforming amendment to change state capital back to Juneau. Is there an objection?
Object.
Representative Gatto objects. And my interest is in returning the bill to its original form. Where it says an act providing that during the governor's term of office, the duty station of the governor is Juneau. Discussion?
Mr. Chairman, sorry, it's
version P.
Rather than discussion, it's just a little bit of confusion. Sorry.
And version C is in CAT.
Oh, see, I'm on the wrong version. Oh, that would be the confusion. I don't know that I have the C version, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we'll take a brief piece. Back on the record, on the advice of counsel, I'd like to declare conflict of interest since I'm running for statewide office.
I'll object.
Thank you, Representative Grimmenberg.
For the record.
Thank you. Representative Lynn?
I don't want to delay the bill. I think it appears to me that most of us are in agreement with the basic bill.
You're not delaying the bill, Representative Lynn. It's 1:20 in the afternoon. We got lots of time.
I know, but we all have things to do.
No, we don't. We're here till 3 o'clock. We can debate this as long as you want. We can stay later. We can come back tonight. Just make your point.
I'll just not make my point.
Okay. Is there other discussion? Representative Gatto.
It's just too simple an amendment to have much discussion.
I agree.
Make a left or a right turn.
Understood.
Make one, you can't make the other.
Is there other discussion? Is the objection maintained? Yes, Susan, we take the roll, please.
Representative Gatto.
No.
Representative Lynn.
No.
Representative Grimmenberg.
No.
Representative Holmes.
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Yes.
Representative Herron.
Yes.
Representative Ramirez.
Yes.
4 yes, 3 no.
Thank you. So with that, amendment, conceptual amendment number 2 passes, changing back to Juneau and a conforming amendment. Is there's another mention, Susan, on page 2, line 7, I think. So with that, are there any other amendments? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dahlstrom.
I wish to move House CS for Senate Bill number 244, version C, with the attached conceptual amendment, physical note, and individual recommendations.
Thank you. Is there an objection? Seeing none, the bill passes from committee. We'll take a brief at ease. Darwin, thank you very much. House Bill 423, version E, as in Eric. We have nobody in the room who wishes to testify, and the only person we have online is Dave Jones with the Department of Law, who's available to answer questions. We also, members should also have a memo from Dennis Bailey, ordered by Representative Lindsay Holmes for an opinion concerning the constitutional issues raised by House Bill 423.
And Mr. Chairman, on that, I apologize for not getting that out earlier. We're at the point of session. Things are moving so fast, I kind of forgot that the bill was up today, and I would have distributed it earlier.
Nope, no problem. Representative Gatto, the floor is yours. If you'll just introduce yourself, just so Susan has it for the record, please.
Thank you. Carl Gatto, Representative District 13, Palmer. Short title of the bill is the Alaska Health Freedom Act, and the substance of the bill is the word policy. The bill makes it a policy of the state that a person has the right to choose a form of health care that they see best fit. The background is that to some people it's clear, to many people it's almost perfectly clear that the federal government overstepped its reach in forcing consumers to buy a product that they had no intention of buying or simply refused to buy. That is the essence of the 10th Amendment. The 10th Amendment says that certain rights are reserved to the states, and health insurance has been the state's prerogative for, I don't know, about decades anyway, for sure. So the point being that because the federal government's health care plan is going to cost every state in the union a substantial amount of money, and, you know, there was always some controversy over that, and some people from Washington said, no, it's going to save you money, but individual states have always said it's going to cost us money. So I reviewed Florida's analysis of the plan, and they expect to be out about $1 billion a year because of the requirements. And so, Ms. Chair, there's a couple things I'll hear. I want to read into the record here. The Supreme Court held in Snap and Son Incorporated versus Puerto Rico that an important indicator of a state standing to sue is whether the injury is one that the state, if it could, would likely attempt to address through its sovereign lawmaking powers. So passing the bill proves that Alaska would assert its sovereign powers. And we're not, just 1 second here. Before the federal law passed, no one required us to buy anything. This law has changed, literally, this is the game changer. And so what we want to have is a policy for the state that says it's the state's prerogative to say that we don't have to buy something we don't want to. The reason it's important is because this is likely but not certain to go to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court doesn't have to have an all or nothing agreement. Supreme Court could nullify certain parts of the existing law that they passed. Or it could say those states at this point that have their own policies and stick to their policies, all others must go with the newer policies. So with that, Mr. Chair, that is it. Ready for questions.
Roger that. Questions for the sponsor? Are there questions for Dave Jones with the Department of Law? He's available.
Well, I do.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, and I guess this question, the sponsor may be able to answer it, or Mr. Jones. I'm wondering if you've had conversations with the Attorney General on what his opinion is, considering the work that they are doing right now investigating this issue. My understanding is, and I believe it's with the same intent of your legislation. Have you had that conversation?
Representative Dahlstrom, I have, as far back as January, before the bill had passed, where I personally met with the Attorney General in Anchorage, went to his office, carried with me a letter requesting that he join with several other states in pursuing action against the federal government. He could not commit to it at the time. My personal impression was he thought it was probably the right thing to do, but that's my personal impression. Later on, we had the Attorney General in the bill being directed to do that for us. That was deleted from the bill. There is a issue of separation of powers, and my guess is the Attorney General is also instructed by the governor to look into this. I think that decision, as was mentioned by the chair, is forthcoming. It's not necessary to be in the bill. The job of the Attorney General is to look after the state's legal rights. So that's as far as I have taken it.
Follow up.
Representative Dahlstrom?
So you were having conversations on it before the national bill even
Correct.
Passed. Mr. Chair, may I have, Mr. Jones, could you comment on a stand if you're able to publicly make a statement on it that the Attorney General might have on this piece of legislation?
This is Dave Jones. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Alaska in the Department of Law. Through the Chair, Representative Dahlstrom, the Attorney General is reviewing the federal health care reform legislation and will, in consultation with the Governor, make a decision about appropriate action concerning that legislation. He has not yet made that determination.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. So if this piece of legislation was passed, would it help or hinder the process?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, I don't know that it would have a helpful effect or a hindering effect. I'm not quite certain what effect it might have, but I can't say with certainty that it would either help or hinder.
That's this legislation?
Yes.
Well, it's helpful to me. I mean, I'm glad to galvanize the point of view of those Alaskans who feel like I do, and presumably the sponsor, Representative Gatto, and I worked together on introducing this as a Judiciary Committee bill. I think it galvanizes the offense that many Americans and in our case Alaskans take at having their basic rights encroached upon. I stand with the bill sponsor, Representative Gatto.
Yeah, here, I mean, I'm just going to spin these by you. That's a lot of people that took the time to sign on saying, please do this.
Representative Gatto, I see small print at the header that. Can you read the petition that was signed by the public into the record, please?
Petition demanding Alaska join in legal action to repeal federal health care bill. There's a lot more small print here. I can read it. You want me to finish?
I think it would be helpful.
Sure. With the passage of the health care reform bill, America is teetering toward tyranny. A mandate requiring all individuals to purchase health insurance is an unprecedented form of federal action. The legal challenge by the states appears to be the only hope of protecting the American people from this unprecedented attack on our system of government. At least 15 states are instituting legal action to challenge the constitutionality of the health care reform bill. Alaska should take its place in the list of states and join in the legal fight. By signing this petition, you are demanding the governor and attorney general join in the legal action to repeal the health care bill.
Thank you. And who drafted that language, Representative Gatto?
I couldn't tell you. Perhaps Representative Tom Riker can help me with the language issue.
I just think it's helpful to read
I
read
can
it.
Tell you who the petitions are being returned to, and they're being returned to the Conservative Patriots Group in Wasilla.
And the signatories on that, are they from a particular region in Alaska, or are they across?
Well, I'm looking at phone numbers here. There's an awful lot of Matt Valley phone numbers. That's the headquarters. It goes out to Big Lake. It goes into Anchorage. But I see an awful lot of familiar prefixes.
Yes, well, it would certainly be representative of exchanges in the Fairbanks area as well. Please introduce yourself for the record. And
Chairman Ramirez, I'm Thomas Riker, staff to Representative Carl Gatto. And to answer your question, I believe that language was generated by the Conservative Patriots Group.
Thank you, Thomas. And the Conservative Patriots Group, I've read about them in the Anchorage Daily News. They have a chapter presently in the Valley, but they're expanding to other parts of the state. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. Any other questions for Thomas or for the bill sponsor, Representative Grunberg, or for Mr. Jones with the Department of Law? Representative Gatto? Representative Grunberg? Representative Holmes?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have this legal opinion that I distributed, which basically weighs in on the success on the 10th Amendment issues. I'm a little hesitant to get into that merits of that with the Attorney General's office, simply because they are considering bringing a lawsuit, and so I think the answer that we get would probably be that they don't really want to comment on the success or failure of a lawsuit that they may or may not be filing, Mr. Chairman. So I'm kind of loath to put the Department of Law on the spot on those sorts of issues. So I have definitely some comments when we get more to the committee discussion. I'm not sure so much their questions at this time.
Thank you. Representative Heron, then Grunberg, then Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question to Representative Gatto. Sir, of course, the first committee referral was Health and Social Services, and we were, at least I think we tried to carefully frame the discussion around health policy as related to the state, as related to this legislation, and that we tried to limit this discussion when it came to the constitutionality of this proposed legislation. Could you please comment on that?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Heron. I think we shortened the bill considerably, took out various parts, and left it in general as just the Alaska policy in moving forward. So if a person were to say how much teeth is in here, that there may be no teeth if the Supreme Court rules against us, then everything we do here has no value. The idea behind the act is to influence the Supreme Court as one more, yet one more state out of a large group of states that says we believe that the federal government has overreached. That will be the essence of the bill. I think they will talk about the 9th, 10th, and 11th Amendments as far as the ability of the federal government to have passed the health care bill.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Grimberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jones, can you hear me?
To the chair, Representative Grimberg, yes, I can.
Okay. First, I'd like to ask you a question or two or three on the fiscal note. Do you happen to have, are you the person to ask about this fiscal note dated 4/10, signed by Eileen Donahue, Division Operations Manager in the Division of Administrative Services? Question.
Through the chair, Representative Grimberg, I can give it a shot. I don't have it in front of me.
Well, it's an indeterminate fiscal note, and it says that it provides the it says that the act provides the policy is that the person may choose or decline any mode of obtaining health care services without penalty or threat of penalty. The bill's apparently designed to counter the individual health insurance requirements of recently enacted federal legislation. The bill includes definitions of mode of obtaining health care services and penalty. The bill provides that the policy does not apply to health care services provided or required by the state, a political subdivision of the state, or a court of the state, and that the policy may not impair a contract right or that provides health care services. Thus, the fiscal impact to the Department of Law is indeterminate. I don't think that the conclusion flows from those statements. Why, in fact, is the fiscal note indeterminate? Did you hear the question, sir?
To the chair, Representative Grimberg, I did not hear a question. I thought I heard a comment.
No. My question was, after that soliloquy, it's like a leading question. A soliloquy is followed by monosyllabic responses, but I do want a longer response.
What was that?
I'll tell you later. Monosyllabic.
Monosyllabic, thank you.
So we'll look that up later. But the,
why is it indeterminate?
Yeah, the question is, why is the fiscal note indeterminate?
Through the chair, Representative Grimberg, because we don't know what the effect of the bill on the fiscal operations of the Department of Law will be. It's unclear whether, first of all, it's unclear what the governor and the attorney general will decide to do. One of the options would be to, for example, join the existing suit in Florida. In that situation, it's possible that there would be no appreciable fiscal impact on the state because others would be handling that litigation. Another possibility would be that the state would institute its own suit. In that case, the fiscal impact on the Department of Law might be more significant because others wouldn't be financing it. And that's why the fiscal note is indeterminate.
Mr. Chair, if I may follow up.
Yes.
Might you also just decide to file an amicus brief?
Through the chair, Representative Grimberg, that is a possibility. And in that case, the fiscal impact on the Department of Law might be insignificant.
Thank you. And if you did file simply an amicus brief, might that limit your exposure for the other side's attorney's fees?
Through the chair, Representative Grimberg, it might, but I can't say that it would eliminate the possibility. I'm just not certain of the circumstances in which that might arise.
because I'm not aware of any circumstance where the court even has jurisdiction to award attorney's fees against a party who has simply filed an amicus brief. They can only do that, to my understanding, under the civil rule 82, if the potential person to pay those fees is a party to the suit. Is that not your interpretation of Rule 82?
Through the chair, Representative Grinberg, for cases filed in Alaska or cases filed in federal courts in which they're applying Alaska law for attorney's fees, that would be true. I'm unaware of any existing cases in Alaska or in Alaska district courts, for federal district courts in Alaska, that are currently entertaining suits pertaining to the federal health care legislation.
I understand through the chair. Under other federal law, if you were to join that lawsuit or file a suit in another jurisdiction, is there a federal law that provides potential exposure to the state if it loses to pay the other side's attorney's fees?
There are, through the chair, Representative Grinberg, there are some federal laws, notably Section 1988 of Title 42 of the U.S. Code, that provide for recovery of attorney's fees. I don't know whether that would be applicable to this type of litigation.
That's in the Federal Civil Rights Act, is it not?
That's correct.
Okay. Let me see. Okay, that's all my questions to Mr. Jones. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you. Are there other questions for Mr. Jones?
I do.
Representative Gatto?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jones, we have had offers from organizations to support us with money, and my guess is they will support many of the states with money. If we were to be on the wrong end of the argument and there was a recovery of costs, would that all fall on the organization, or would it revert back to the organizations who they represented?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I don't know. I suppose it might depend on whatever agreement we were to reach with the supporting organizations.
Yeah. Could I ask you to let Mr. Reichert speak?
Sure. Thomas?
Through the chair, just to the committee, we had the same concerns that Representative Grunberg did. It's a very unclear analysis in the fiscal note. We contacted Department of Law about that, and I talked to Mike Ford today. They are going to revise that summary to make it more clear for the Finance Committee and make it, you know, explicitly lay out for them why it's an indeterminate fiscal note. I would also say, to the point of organizations paying for this, I also spoke to the Goldwater Institute, who had offered to defend the constitutionality of the Health Care Freedom Act at no cost to the states. I wanted to get some more guidance as to what exactly that meant. Realistically, it's probably going to mean that they cherry-pick the state that whose act they think has the best shot at winning a court challenge and defend that state. The reality of that being, though, that if they prevail in that court challenge, it's going to apply to everybody who enacted the Health Care Freedom Act. So even though they might not be directly representing the state of Alaska, all of these bills have language that says whatever state is passing them declares as their policy that the individual mandate doesn't apply in their state. And so if that argument gets upheld in court, it's going to apply to every state, not just to whatever state the Goldwater Institute chooses to defend.
Mr. Chair. This is to Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones, I'd like to call your and the committee's attention to AS 4423020 sub B 3. The Attorney General shall represent the state in all civil actions in which the state is a party. And I it was unclear. I don't think I read the text of the material that talked about the Goldwater Institute, so I guess I should ask Thomas this question first, if I may direct the question at him instead, Mr. Chair. Did the Goldwater Institute offer to defend the state or pay the state's cost?
I asked about that, through the chair, Representative Grinberg. This is Thomas Riker's staff for Representative Carl Gatto. I asked them about that specifically, and they would not reimburse the state's costs. They would offer to argue the the case for the state. So I would assume that that provision of Alaska law would also factor in their decision as to whether to make Alaska the state that they chose to defend in court. Because, you know, if there are states out there who don't have that provision and whose law does allow for an outside party, you know, to make arguments on behalf of their law, then obviously they're probably going to go with defending that state as opposed to Alaska.
Through the chair to Mr. Riker. Yeah, I can see what you're talking about here. The AG would actually be representing the state, and they would enter into an agreement with the outside counsel to do the brief and or argument. I see what we're talking about here. Okay, and they're doing that in these other cases, too.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, all of these bills are still working their way through every state's legislative process, so they haven't initiated that yet, but that is their publicly stated, and they confirmed for me today on the phone that that is their intention, to work with these states to work out some agreement where they can make the arguments in court on behalf of the state.
That would include written and oral?
Through the chair, I believe so.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Representative Gatto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the edification of committee members, when you develop legislation, we always run into unintended bumps in the road. And it was discovered that as a state employee, all state employees are required to have health insurance. So we had to look at the language that we had in there that says you're entitled to whatever health insurance you want. And then we discovered the university had required health insurance. And then finally, we discovered that in any kind of court action, sometimes you can require the losing party to provide health insurance. And I thought we reached the bottom of the barrel there, so we carved out those exceptions in the bill so that we wouldn't run into some legal conflicts.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Are we starting to get into the amendment here, or was that just a general comment?
Is there an amendment?
There are two.
Yes, there are two.
And that was to Representative Gatto. Are you starting to get into that?
Is there more discussion?
Well, do you want to have committee discussion at this point, Mr. Chairman, or are we still in questions?
Well, I think we were still asking the bill sponsor and Thomas some questions. So if there are more questions for the bill sponsor.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the CS that came out of Hess did that. Our amendments are meant to tailor that language a little bit, but there's already language in this CS that carves out those exemptions.
I understand that. I was just an inquiry. I don't care how we proceed because we'll get all roads will lead to Rome one way or the other. Here.
All right, are there more questions for Thomas? Anybody else in the room wishes to speak on this? Anybody else online other than Mr. Jones? Mr. Jones, will you please stand by while we have this discussion?
Yes, Chair, I shall.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jones. Seeing no more questions for the bill sponsor, let's proceed to amendments. Representative Gatto, you have amendments for your bill?
I do. Mr. Chair, I'll move amendment number one, labeled
the header page
shorter.
One
this one here, there aren't any references on them.
Page one, line nine is amendment number one. Is that right?
That's the one.
I'll
right.
Object for discussion.
Okay. So Representative Gatto moves amendment number one. Representative Holmes objects for the purposes of discussion. Members should have before them an amendment that begins with page one, line nine, and then says delete and may choose or. Representative Herron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll object for the purposes of discussion. Representative Herron? Or Representative Holmes did.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To amendment number one, of course, we carefully reviewed this in the previous committee, but I'm looking at your sponsor statement, and you like the to choose and or the word choose, but in this amendment, you're taking choose out of the legislation. How come?
I think it's technical. I'm trying to keep the language as short as possible. If Representative Grugelberg is saying no.
No, I'm just saying I hope we don't do this. I think it's important to have choose in. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted. Excuse me, folks.
It was a matter of finding language that really didn't support the statement. If you delete and may choose, it reads a person has the right to decline.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
Representative Gatto, I guess the way I see it is then you're denying, there is some sort of denial that they have a right to choose.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gatto, who helped you draft this? What was the objective of amendment number one? Thomas, you want to come back up here? How about your boss?
Through the chair, this is Thomas Riker, staff to Representative Carl Gatto. Representative Herron, the intention here is, number one, what's really disputed in the federal bill is not the idea that you're going to have more choices out there in what health care you choose. It's that you're not going to have the right to decline to choose a private service with your private goods that you don't want. And so this was to tailor the language of that. In addition, we struggled with the word provided. I know we did tangle over that in Hess, but if you look at the other thing that the amendment changes, page 1, line 13, we understand that the intention of that was to make sure that all current insurance policy of the state wasn't affected by this bill. But at the same time, we didn't want it to be read, as we talked about in Hess, to in any way allow people to make a claim on services that they're not entitled to based upon their income or whatever the case may be. And we really struggled with that insertion of the word provided by, because our real intent here was to make sure the state wasn't requiring you, not that you could conceivably argue that the state had to provide you with more than you'd already been given. So we just wanted to narrow the language a little bit more to specifically what we found objectionable about the federal health care law, and that was the impetus of the amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Holmes, then Herron.
Mr. Chairman, I'm struggling to remember exactly. I was also on the Hess Committee, and we had several days of discussion, very interesting discussion on this bill. And the provided or, as I recall, was put in at the suggestion, I believe it was Mr. Ford from the AG's office, who recommended that we add that language that required was not going to get us where we needed to go. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm that second half. I'm not particularly in love with the first half of the amendment, but and then the second half, I'm troubled because, as I recall, that was the Attorney General's office who recommended that would be a good idea.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg, then Herron.
Just because these are two separate subjects in the single amendment, I think it'll be a little easier if we divide the question. And I would ask lines 1 and 2 be Amendment 1A and 4 and 5 be 1B. And that'll just keep our discussion focused on each of the sections. Ask unanimous consent.
I'm going to check with the bill sponsor, Representative Gatto.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to withdraw the amendment.
Amendment number 1 is withdrawn. Representative Gatto, like to move amendment number 2.
Mr. Chair, I'll move amendment number 2.
I'll object for discussion.
Representative Holmes objects for the purposes of discussion. Susan, amendment number 2 is the one that starts on page 1, line 8, after A, insert. So if I understand, it would say declaration of policy for securing health services, A. Then it would read, pursuant to the 9th and 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, it is the policy of the state of Alaska that a person has the right to and may choose or decline any mode of obtaining health care services without penalty or threat of penalty.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Is there discussion? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not a great fan, needless to say, of the bill, but I do think that the amendment does have some merit, but I would point out a shortcoming. That not being an attorney who's involved with the case, there may be other legal arguments as well. There may be certain federal laws that ultimately they'll want to say this law conflicts with, and I don't know how this will morph, but I would not recommend, you know, I don't have a problem if you really want to put this in. If I were drafting this, I would not, because you don't know ultimately the arguments the lawyers will use.
Thank you. I don't want to get into a peripatetic discussion here, so let's just stay very focused. Representative Gatto.
Thank you to Representative Grunberg. Putting the specific language in there, does that confine the bill to that language so that other language would have a lesser value?
May I respond?
Representative Grunberg.
That's what my concern would be. I would hope you would withdraw it. Because I don't think, from your point of view, you want to tie the strings of the litigators.
Right. I'm easy. Chair, I'll withdraw amendment number 2.
Amendment number 2 is withdrawn. Are there any other amendments? Seeing none, we have the original bill before us. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I am going to, at this point, make a couple of comments on my concerns, which I think are not going to come as a great shock to the bill sponsor, since, as I said, we had a pretty lengthy discussion in the prior committee. On the legal issues, the one issue, we were pretty careful in Hess not to get into the constitutional issues, so I guess I'll address that first. You have, all of you, a legal opinion from Dennis Bailey dated April 9th. And on the second page, if I may very briefly, Mr. Chairman, read a couple of sentences out of this. I think that some of the relevant sentences from this are, to the extent that the recently signed Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act specifically regulates state insurance by requiring everyone to obtain health care insurance, the federal law would likely be found to preempt state law on the subject. If you drop down a few lines, it says, if a power is delegated to Congress by the Constitution, the 10th Amendment does not protect the states from the exercise of that federal power. The federal Constitution gives Congress the power to control commerce. In light of the ruling in U.S. v. Southeastern Underwriters Association that the business of insurance is part of interstate commerce, it's reasonable to conclude that the power to regulate commerce and thus regulate insurance has been delegated to the United States Congress by the Constitution. Therefore, it seems unlikely that a court would hold that the 10th Amendment would prevent the federal government from implementing a bill specifically regulating insurance. Mr. Chairman, I read that language as saying that that there is that what we're attempting to do here is probably not going to be terribly successful. That being said, I understand that there are people in the building who are going to want to proceed with it anyway. I think that it's probably not going to be terribly successful.
Just legal.
But, Mr. Chairman, I have secondary and actually far more relevant concern. I think that the first issue that I raised is one that the Attorney General's office is already making up their own mind on. I think that the governor and the Attorney General are weighing what they think are the balance. They're intelligent people, and they're going to weigh the politics and the likelihood of success, and they're going to make a determination that they believe is in the best interest of the state of Alaska, regardless of what we do here. So I think that issue, whether you think we're going to succeed or fail, is already taken care of without this bill. So my main concerns with the bill are that that lawsuit will go forward or not go forward based on other considerations. What we're doing in this bill is what concerns me, Mr. Chairman, because I think what we heard extensively in Hess, concerns from both the Department of Health and Social Services and from Mr. Ford on behalf of the Department of Law, that they don't really understand what this bill does, and they don't really understand what, if any, effects this bill will have on the Department of Health and Social Services and on the Department of Law, totally irrespective of the federal health care policy. So in my opinion, and my concern with the bill is that in the wake of the recently passed federal legislation, we are focused on that issue, and we're not looking at what this will do to other programs in the state, what this will do to the Department of Law, what this will do to the Health and Social Services Department. And my concern is that they don't know what the effects of this are going to be. The federal law aside, what it's going to do to other programs, other things. And I think that because the goal, I believe the goal of the bill, is really aimed at the federal legislation, and the Attorney General's office is already looking into that issue and will make a decision regardless of this, I think it's risky to put a bill like this into our statutes that we don't understand what it's going to do in other, totally other areas. And so I those are my concerns.
Sometimes I feel like I'm here to reflect the wishes of my constituents. And my constituents have spoken out most clearly this legislative session on two issues. One, their desire not to have winter tires legislated onto their cars. And secondly, that they don't wish to see their country turned into a socialist country led by this president, who I respect greatly for the office, but not for the policies that he is imposing upon our country, which I can little affect, but I share the sentiment of Representative Gatto, who has brought this bill to the legislature through the House Judiciary Committee, that the state of Alaska certainly can express its point of view, and I share Representative Gatto's passion and would as well sign that petition book. So I as is often the case, sit in an exact mirror opposite position of you, Representative Holmes, and find that putting this on the statute books is good for Alaska and good for its citizens and an excellent way for me to represent my constituents. Representative Gatto?
Thank you. Just an answer to Representative Holmes' comments. I'm going to, not being an attorney, we often just go and we ask people for opinions and we search out information that's already written. So I will read you two paragraphs that are short. Two attorneys for the Congressional Research Service determined last summer that Congress is on shaky ground, relying on its authority to regulate interstate commerce to create the so-called individual mandate. Whether such a requirement would be constitutional under the Commerce Clause is perhaps the most challenging question posed by such a proposal, as it is a novel issue whether Congress may use this clause to require an individual to purchase a good or service. We have heard that, Mr. Chair, over and over and over again, that this is the first time in the history of the country that its citizens were required to purchase a product. The background and the Constitution, which is well over 200 years old, certainly makes no mention of a requirement even for health care, much less a requirement that a person have it, much less a requirement that a purchase must buy it against their will. And I think that is the constitutional question that will be raised. My hope is that the Supreme Court will make the decision. In the event they decide against us, then the bill is irrelevant. We have the law of the land, which is the bill that passed Congress. In the event they decide for us, then we have statute in place that at least directs, tells the citizens that that requirement is certainly has not been and will not be in the future or continue to be a requirement. Thank you.
Representative Herron and then Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Interesting discussion, especially in the last committee. And seven people in that committee worked with the sponsor to craft health policy related to the issue of choosing or declining any mode of health care. And so we did that, and with the help of the department, we crafted something that we could forward to this committee to decide the constitutionality of the health delivery services that will be placed in the statute. There is nothing in this that talks about the federal law. We said that in the other committee, and we said it, and we're saying it, at least I'm going to say it in this committee, it has nothing to do with the federal law. This is developing a policy about health delivery services in the state, and now this committee should consider whether it is constitutional to craft that policy. We have no reference to the federal law.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Representative Herron put something before us that is really at the heart of what I see here. I would have felt much more comfortable about this if this were not seen as an attack on an emerging federal law that, because of unusual procedures in the United States Senate, they couldn't finalize. They have to go to a Reconciliation Act now to finalize the law. It's not even in final form. And I would feel much more comfortable if this were a generic statement. I mean, there's not much to argue with on a generic basis. If we did not make this a political statement or referendum against a particular bill that's still in a work in progress. And I'm going to digress. Since it is a work in progress, I wish the rules of the Senate were changed a little bit so that it could have been finalized by now, and then we'd know what it was and what it isn't. But anyway, we deal with what we have. If the avowed purpose were not to get us into a political lawsuit, I would have much more comfort with this. But it is obviously intended to make a political statement and get us into litigation. And I wish it weren't so. And I don't know if there's a way, if the other members or any other members of the committee feel as I do, I would like to keep it clean and not use it as a method of getting into a lawsuit. I suppose anybody, the Attorney General is free to prosecute or defend any case he wishes in the governor. Now, there's nothing I can do about that. But to take something that is fairly benign on its surface and make it a political slogan, or that's not even the right word, but a political tool or whatever you want to call it, implement, I am uncomfortable with that. I'm not uncomfortable generally with the language as it is. I'm not wild about the title. I don't think that's necessary. But the guts of the bill, I feel okay about generally. But I don't really want to get us into a political battle. Is there, I'm asking the bill sponsor anyway around there.
Representative Gatto?
Mr. Chair, this bill, I think it'd almost be laughable if the federal bill hadn't already passed. No one would have expected or even suspected that the federal government would try to do such a thing. But they did. And so now what would have been laughable becomes significant. It wasn't the state that initiated the controversy. The state is really saying under the 10th Amendment, we just want to be able to exercise our rights. Part of our rights are that we have rights not to do something, too. That's what the bill is about.
Mr. Chair.
May I respond? Representative Grunberg.
I understand what you're saying, and I'm not unsympathetic to that. I do think that there's nothing wrong with the bill anyway. You know, it's a right of choice. I wouldn't have any problem with that. We wouldn't have to say it doesn't have good merits on its own or that it's laughable. I think it has merit on its own, and that we wouldn't have had, maybe it's unfortunate that we have to have this controversy to bring this thing forward. I like the idea of people having a choice in the kind of.
Thank you. I'm grateful for the debate. We have ignition interlocks, which will affect Alaskans here. So I'm grateful for the repartee. If there are no more amendments, and Representative Gatto, if you've had your say, and if Representative Grunberg, you've had your counter say, Representative Holmes, I'd just soon to move the bill from committee or take a vote if an objection is maintained. Chair would entertain. Are there any final closing remarks?
Not me.
Okay. Representative Gatto, wrap up?
No wrap up, sir.
Okay. Chair would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for House Bill number 423, version E as in Eric, with attached
indeterminate
fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to object.
Okay. Representative Holmes objects. Susan, will you take a roll, please?
Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Grunberg.
No.
Representative Holmes?
No.
Representative Dahlstrom?
Yes.
Representative Herron?
Yes.
Representative Gatto?
Yes.
Representative Rammers?
Yes.
Four yes. I'm sorry. Five yes, two no.
So by a vote of 5-2, House Bill 423 moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease.
When's our next walk on the floor?
Back on the record, it's 10 minutes after 2. Here in the room is the wonderful Christine, Senator Kevin Meyer. Senator Meyer, we're going to hear this bill today and then hold it over till next Monday. We need to
Monday.
So Max can draft some amendments.
Thank you. And Representative Dahlstrom, if you could move the C version, please. We need to adopt the C version.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the House CS for CS for Senate Bill number 239 version 10/C.
Thank you. Without objection, we have the House CS for CS for Senate Bill 239 before us.
I will not object if somebody discusses the differences.
I'm certain that we shall. Before we get into House Bill 239, Representative Grunberg, you wanted to read something onto the record?
Yes. What was that bill number? 284. With respect to 284, I happened to be unavoidably out of the room when the bill vote was taken. I could not sign the report. I just would like to put on the record I would have been a due pass.
Thank you. Senate Bill 239, an act relating to ignition interlock devices to refusal to submit to a chemical test and to driving while under the influence. In addition to having the bill presented by Senator Meyer, we also have online Josh Fink from Anchorage, who'd like to testify, and then also Jennifer Messick, TSR prosecutor, and Dennis Wheeler, municipal attorney for Anchorage, and then available to answer questions, Doug Moody, Kerry Hennings, and our favorite Alaska State Trooper, Lieutenant Rodney Dial.
I have a couple of favorites.
Yes. I have one.
There you go.
I do too. Senator Meyer, it's a privilege to have you before the committee. The floor is yours. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Judiciary Committee. It's good to be back. It's been kind of a hectic day today, and I appreciate you take the time to hear our bill, Senate Bill 239. And for the record, my name is Kevin Meyer, and I represent South Anchorage Senate District O. This bill pertains to ignition interlock devices, and it seems like you've already heard this bill. You have. We actually passed this 2 years ago as part of a sentencing for driving while under the influence of alcohol. The legislation did become law, and like I said, it's been in place for a couple years. But what we're finding is that this tool hasn't been and isn't being used as we had hoped or had anticipated. In fact, there was in 2009, there was 3,513 court orders requiring ignition interlock, but in that same time period, only about 1,250 were actually installed. And what's concerning here is that we have a lot of laws that we try to implement to try to keep people off the roads if they had too much to drink or if they get caught, that, you know, they're pretty stiff penalties. But this actually prevents them from even starting their car and actually driving if they've been drinking. This bill specifies a time period that an ignition interlock device would need to be installed in order to operate the vehicle. And what it does is kind of stair steps depending on the number of times that they've previously been picked up for DWI. It would be independent of probation, so if someone's probation is shortened or lengthened, the offender would still need to have an ignition interlock device. So, Mr. Chairman, that's basically the bill. Would entertain any questions. Be happy to answer the differences with the CS for Representative Grunberg if he's still interested.
Representative McConnell?
Thanks, Chair. Just an interesting background, Senator Meyer. Representative Grunberg, who's not here, introduced interlock devices in the last century sometime. And then in 2003, I introduced interlock devices. And since then, there have been, this has to be the third change in interlock devices. I guess we're getting closer and closer to where we've arrived. I believe so. So thank you very much for sprucing up, looking at the past history and seeing how it can be best implemented. Just one more note. When we started this, we were trying to figure out a way how to get the drunks out of their cars and increase fines and increase jail sentences. Didn't do it. Increase jail sentences, put them in contact with new drinking buddies. Got worse instead of better. And so we checked with other states, see what they were doing, and we discovered that they had pretty good success with interlock devices. So you're here, we're all here, and I wish Representative Grunberg was here because he started this whole thing back a long time ago. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions for the bill sponsor?
No, I like it.
Compelling, Senator.
Would you like to hear the changes to the CS?
We would, but maybe perhaps we can wait until Representative Grunberg is back since he requested it.
Okay.
Let's go to a testimony, and then we'll come back to you as soon as he's back. Can we hear from Josh Fink, please? Josh, are you with us?
Mr. Chairman, I am with you.
If you'll just introduce yourself for the record, any affiliation, and have at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A pleasure to appear before your committee. It has been a while. My name is Josh Fink, and I'm here on my own behalf. I am an attorney in Anchorage. And I had just a couple of comments on the bill. Before stating those comments, I do want to thank Senator Meyer for his work over the years in combating drunk driving in Alaska. I know he's been in the forefront of this over many years. And we've all benefited from that work. With regard to this legislation,
I support where he's trying to go with it, but I think there may be some consequences that I don't think are intended. I think they're unintended consequences I just wanted to bring to the committee's attention. Currently, the ignition interlock device is tied to either a period of probation, so you only are required to have the ignition interlock device if you are put on probation. This bill would untether that. And then secondly, some judges have ruled that they have the authority to suspend that requirement in certain circumstances, though some don't agree with that, and it's been used in a very limited way. Because this bill untethers the ignition interlock device from the probation period that they would have to have it, and also precludes judges from having discretion, it does a couple of things. One, there is a percentage of cases of OUIs that don't involve alcohol. Those would be cases where someone was arrested on prescription drugs. I have a case right now where someone left the hospital when they weren't being watched and got in their car, and it's an Ambien case. They don't drink. You have cases that of individuals, say, marijuana or other drugs, where no alcohol is involved. I don't know if it makes sense to require those individuals to have an ignition interlock device, which only measures for alcohol, particularly in cases with the prescription drug cases, where they're taking drugs given to them by their doctors, and in some of those cases, those individuals don't drink, yet they would be required to have the ignition interlock device, regardless of whether alcohol is involved. And to that end, I think it's important to note that when this was originally enacted in 1255-102, it has a requirement that the ignition interlock device only be required if alcohol possession or consumption is involved. It wasn't for OUIs that didn't involve alcohol. Now, when they amended the OUI law itself, 2835-030, and the refusal, 2835-032, they didn't make that exception. They required the ignition interlock device in all OUIs. But there is a significant percent that don't involve alcohol, and I think the committee should be made aware of that. I don't know if it makes sense to require this in those cases. Then there is a set of cases that don't involve an automobile, cases where individuals get OUIs on snow machines or four-wheelers, and oftentimes have those, have been, particularly with minors, and oftentimes how those have been handled is, again, because it's tied to probation, we would seek a flat sentence. So let's say someone gets a first OUI, but it was on a snow machine. Instead of 3 days, we might seek 20 days of incarceration, but no probation, and that way they wouldn't be required to have the ignition interlock device. And that's the same thing I've been doing with my prescription drug cases. I handle quite a few of these cases. If someone has an OUI on prescription drugs, we'll seek to increase the sentence and avoid probation so they don't have to have the ignition interlock device, or we'll ask the judge to waive that requirement. Again, some judges believe they have that authority, some don't. This bill expressly takes that authority away. Then there's another category of cases that involve minors that don't have an automobile. And there are others besides minors, but that's the category that jumps out at me. They don't have an automobile to put an ignition interlock device on. Their parents still may want them to take siblings to school and may monitor them, but they're not going to give them a car to go put an ignition interlock device on that then everyone else in the household would be subjected to. And in those cases, we can argue for a much longer sentence, but without probation, to try to work with those unique circumstances. And another category that I think is worth noting, I represent quite a few people here in the military in Anchorage. The consequences are huge when they are charged. They're pre-conviction consequences. It doesn't matter whether they're convicted or not. They lose pay grade. They lose promotions. They can be prevented from being promoted, and I've got a number of cases where they've almost been thrown out of the military. And these are young men and women who have served their country well, have done tours of duty overseas. One of the ways we've addressed that on the criminal side with the state and the city is seeking, again, extended sentences. So say instead of 3 or 4 days on a first, a 20 or 30-day sentence. I can think of one case in particular, a crew chief had done 2 tours of duty overseas, 25 years old, no criminal history, just had a child. We were able to keep him in the military, but they said if he had the ignition interlock device requirement, they would not keep him in the military. He had to drive around vehicles on base in the shops. He worked on F-15s. We got him a 20-day flat sentence, no probation. The military allowed him to keep his job. So that sort of ability to work with unique cases, I think, are taken away if you untether it to probation, and if you expressly preclude judges from being able, in unique circumstances, to waive that requirement. I think, you know, one solution to that, there's four different sections of the bill that take away that express discretion, would be to give the judges the discretion in unique circumstances, or maybe put some sideboards on that. Another way would be to require the ignition interlock device only in those cases that are alcohol-related offenses, as 1255-102 was originally drafted, and still reads. If alcohol is not involved in the OUI, I don't know that it makes a lot of sense to require the installation of the ignition interlock device. Otherwise, I appreciate where the sponsor is going with this legislation, and again, appreciate his hard work on it. Apologize for not getting these concerns to him earlier, and that would conclude my testimony.
Enjoy. Josh, thank you very much. Are there questions for Josh at the table? Josh, I don't see any. We thank you very much for your testimony. Can we go next to Jennifer Messick, please?
Mr. Chairman, this is Dennis Wheeler with the Municipality of Anchorage, and I have here with me Jennifer Messick, the Traffic Safety Resource Prosecutor.
Thank you. Would either of you introduce yourself for the record and offer us your testimony, please?
Yes, sir. Thank you. I'll start, and Jennifer will rescue me if I get off track here.
Thank you. For the record, Dennis, Stacey Schubert is here with us, so she's keeping a watchful eye on your testimony, if one can keep a watchful eye on audio testimony.
Great. Thank you, sir. The focus of our comments is on the potential for a circumstance where someone who is working to comply with the provisions of the IID are punished for their missteps, whereas someone who does not bother to get a license and then follow through with the subsequent IID provisions actually faces lower penalties. And therefore, what I think you're seeing in the stats referenced earlier by Senator Meyer is that some people recognize that it's to their financial advantage to not get relicensed so that they can avoid the stiffer penalties and the expense of going through the IID process. Jennifer has suggested there may be some small changes to the language that would fix this, where the IID requirement stands alone as a criminal offense, such that regardless of whether or not you're licensed, you would still face the potential penalty for failure to have the device or use the device when you're operating a vehicle. That's the best way I can put it into a thumbnail. I'll let Jennifer take it from there. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Good afternoon. This is Jennifer. I'm specifically referencing some new added language to AS 2815-291, which is the driving with license and book.
Could you just introduce yourself by your first name, last name for the recording session?
I'm sorry, Jennifer Messick.
Thank you. And your title, please?
I'm a traffic safety resource prosecutor for the Municipality of Anchorage.
Perfect. Thank you. Please proceed.
Specifically, AS 2815-291, subsection B, has some minor amendments. Subsection C says if the person was driving in violation of an ignition interlock device requirement following that revocation. The problem is that when you look at the DUI statute, 2835-030, you're only required to have it after you regain the privilege to drive. And so what's happening is that people get convicted for DUI and they don't bother regaining the privilege to drive. They just go ahead and drive without the ignition interlock and without a license. And then they basically face just suspended time on a first DWLR, whereas you get other people who go through the hoops, they get their license back, they get the IID, then for whatever reason they're caught, you know, driving the spouse's car without it, and they face a mandatory minimum of 30 days in jail. So it's actually creating a situation where you're giving people an incentive not to get the IID and not to get relicensed. I think that the added language is good, but it's still somewhat deficient, again, because it says under 2815-291, if the person was driving in violation of an ignition interlock device requirement following that revocation, while the requirement is only in place once they regain their privilege to drive. It would be my suggestion that we could leave that language the way it is and simply fix AS 2835030, would be B1A, to read instead of after the person regains the privilege, we could simply say any time a person drives or operates a motor vehicle, and for a period of 6 months after they regain the privilege to drive.
Well, Jennifer, this is the chairman. You know, I come from Fairbanks, which is a community where we just arrested somebody for their eighth DUI. And in a separate case, to validate the vast intellect in my community in the interior, we had a handcuffed person who then tried to steal the Alaska State Trooper patrol car. And so there's little that we can do to keep criminals in the interior or in South Central or in the vast expanses of Alaska from behaving stupidly. Criminals that commit criminal behavior. We were just having that discussion this morning, Jane Pearson and I were, about the restoration of gun rights, and we were discussing SISs and going 10 years without a felony. And so often those people that choose a life of wrongdoing make those decisions not so intermittently that generally 10 years goes by. Usually before the SIS is up, they're right back before a judge. My friend Schaefer Cox is a good example of that. What is he up in? Also in the interior, and so the concern that we have is that people that are on suspended licenses, 10 days, 30 days, 6 months, 1 year, 10 years, a lifetime, tend to get behind the wheel of a car, and drive anyway. And so what I want to hear from is to balance your thoughts for improving the language of this bill and the bill sponsor's intent, which is to try and focus on those people that are trying to be law-abiding, because those folks that are going to leap over the rules and borrow a friend's car or a spouse's car have six drinks and then go to a Cal Worthington Ford and take a demo car. I mean, people that are going to drink and drive find a way to drink and drive, and yet we have a broad category, I think, of citizens who err, make mistakes, and want to find the pathway back to being law-abiding. And I think that that's the intent behind Senator Myers's bill. And I want to be careful that we don't take this bill out to the nth degree and try and capture people who aren't going to abide by the rules anyway. And so I will ask us as we try and go through the committee work on this bill, that we balance those point of views and that we focus more prominently upon those folks that want to find their way back into the rules of society and quiet enjoyment that the rest of us want to live, and not focus on those that are so errant that they're going to break whatever rules we put out there in order to drink and drive. If that's good direction for the bill sponsor and for you also, Jennifer.
Yes, and I agree with what you're saying. I just think that the way that the current statute and penalty scheme is configured, it gives the majority of people an incentive to just not comply, not get their license back, not get the IID, and drive around DWLR. There's a very small fraction of people who actually jump through those hoops, and I would be less concerned about those people because they do get the IID, they do get their license back. If in some situation they get caught driving, somebody else's car without one, I think they should be rewarded or not penalized as heavily because they did get their license back, they did get their ignition interlock device, as opposed to, the other people who just kind of thumb their nose at the whole system. And I say thumb their nose, but the reality is that it's very, very expensive to get your license back. You both have to comply with alcohol treatment, and you have to get the ignition interlock device. Then you have to also pay a reinstatement fee. And the reality is, I think a lot of people, they kind of don't make that a financial priority for themselves, or they can't afford it. So, again, those people who do everything that we ask of them, they get their license back, then for whatever reason they're caught driving a vehicle without it, I don't think that they should get 30 days in jail, whereas a person who never got the IID, never got their license back, merely gets no jail and all suspended time.
I think I'll throw that one. I think I grasp what you're saying. I think I'll throw that one back at the bill sponsor, and I think this is an issue of parity for those that are trying to abide by the rules and those that don't abide by the rules. And, Senator, I'd ask you to address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I understand what she's recommending as well. The intent here is, now you can drive with a limited license. But the concern is that if you're driving from your home, say, to downtown Anchorage, you can stop at many bars, or there's a bar right on the way, so you could still be driving intoxicated. I guess the approach we're taking here is we don't care where you drive. We just want to make sure you're driving sober. So even though you got that one DWI because you had too much wine at a wedding or something, you should still be able to go to work. You should be able to go take your kids to soccer. You may need to go to the doctor. You may want to go to the treatment. You should be able to go wherever you want to. But with the ignition interlock, you're assured to be driving sober. I think what she's saying is that some people won't even try to go through that process of getting the ignition interlock. They're just going to jump in the car and keep driving until they get caught again. And I think she's suggesting then that they have a tougher penalty, and maybe that should be addressed in a different bill. Am I grasping what she's saying?
Christine, you want to bail your boss out? It happened to me this morning. Just go with it, Senator.
If it pleases the chair, I'd like to go over a couple of changes that happened in the CS, which addresses Representative Grunberg's question as well as some of the issues that was just raised about penalties if you don't even bother trying to get the ignition interlock device.
Yes, ma'am. Would you introduce yourself just for the record, Christine?
This is Christine Marisigan. I am staffer to Senator Kevin Meyer. On page 2 of your CS, on lines 18 through 20 and lines 26 through 28, the language that Jennifer was referring to, where we were trying to accommodate kind of these issues of people who were not getting the ignition interlock device but not seeming to have a penalty, we have added them in with the people who are driving with their license revoked. And when she was referring to that DWLR, that's what she was referring to was driving with your license revoked. And the language there states that the person driving that's in violation of an ignition interlock device requirement, that here that we've put in the times, some mandatory time, some mandatory community work service, as well as a fine. I believe that Jennifer was referring to adding even jail time at that point in terms of addressing people who were not getting the ignition interlock device. But so far, in terms of the context of this bill, that's the language that we have added to make sure that those that are making a good faith effort to try to do this are a little bit more rewarded than those who are not.
Yeah, that was my response.
We understand.
Representative Grunberg.
Just one thing I was thinking. You could have a person who is convicted not of a DWI, but of, say, a criminally negligent homicide. They got a conviction for that because it resulted in a death. Is there any place in the law that would impose these requirements for somebody who was convicted of a, and I'm going to use an example, a criminally negligent homicide?
Yes, I hope so.
Involving driving while intoxicated, so that they'd have to have an ignition interlock at some point there too. Those are the really serious cases, and I would think that you might consider putting something in here that would mandate the use of an interlock there. And if you're interested, I'm happy to work with you on that. But we've had some people who are pretty seriously drunk and caused deaths, and I think they should, might consider having them have an interlock requirement on that, too. Through the chair, to the senator, and Christine.
And Mr. Chair, and Representative Grunberg, if I understand what you're saying, is they didn't necessarily get a DWI. They got a much tougher penalty.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and we want to keep those guys from driving in the future as well.
Yeah, without an ignition interlock for a period, whatever you suggest.
Yeah. I don't think we had ever addressed that. You know, our focus was just on those who get convicted.
Would you be interested in doing that?
The clock is working against us, Representative Gruenberg.
Speak for yourself.
You said we had all day, remember?
I'm known as the fastest amendment in the West.
I do. It's now it's now 2:35. We're happy to recess to the call of the chair if that's helpful to you. We would like to move this bill out before 5 p.m. today when we can convene so that it can be read across before we go into session. So I'd be happy to take an ease and have you confer with the...
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think there was another comment made, and maybe we should finish testimony.
We certainly will. I was just going to take a brief at ease to see whether it was something you want to work out or whether we're going to try and go through this. I'm very comfortable to move through this bill.
Okay. Okay. Then...
Senator? Christine, do you want to take us through the rest of the CS changes?
Representative Rems, Mr. Chair, that's the most significant change between the bill from its change in Senate Judiciary until now has been the addition of that language. And also as a precursor to discuss any additional additions of having any other interlock device requirements for other types of crimes. And I would like to point out that New Mexico has gone to a very, very high bar of requiring ignition interlock devices. It had then required the state then to create a fund that would then pay for these ignition interlock devices. What this bill focuses on is basically what is in statute in terms of the stair-stepping, the penalties for DUI. Right now, as it stands, people who have to pay to have this ignition interlock device put on, those fees can be added towards and paid towards their fine. Once we start talking about other more serious crimes, especially things like murder and homicide, I think we're getting out of the realm of what we're talking about in terms of fines defined by the DUI statute.
Very good. Do we have any more questions for Mr. Wheeler or for Ms. Messick? Representative Gruenberg?
I'm at your service if you want to take a few minutes. So we could meet your requirements. I think we could probably do it if you want, whatever you want.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I think you bring up a good point, but I think Christine, too, has brought up an equally good point that you're talking about a whole different class of crime when you talk about manslaughter. And I wouldn't mind visiting this at some point in time, but I think right now I'd like to just keep it focused. Thank you.
This is the last committee referral on the House side for this piece of legislation, then goes to the Rule Committee. Representative Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask the question now. I don't know whether it's appropriate since the person who spoke to it was already offline, but I was just at some point I was wondering if the bill sponsor would respond to the issues that were brought up by Mr. Fink of the driving under the influence that didn't involve alcohol, because that seemed like an interesting question.
If it pleases the chair, I'd like to respond to that question. Representative Holmes, through the chair, yes, there was brought up the idea of drugged driving, which is a problem. We have a lot of cases where people are taking Ambien or perhaps driving under the influence of marijuana where you can't do a breathalyzer test, and certainly any kind of blood test would take too long. And so, you know, they refer it as being drugged, as in drug driving, and I know that there's been some revision of statutes concerning that. I think that one way to fix that, or to fix it in terms of like what this specific bill deals with, is there's still needing some sort of flexibility in dealing with those specific cases. And my suggestion would simply be to be on page 4 and page 6 on lines 28 and line 6 respectively. So that's page 4, mm-hmm. line 28, and page 6, line 6. Mm-hmm. Would be to, on that line where it has the suspension of the requirement of the ignition interlock device, to have it specifically, you know, only for alcohol violations would be the one way to deal with that. Another issue that was brought up by Mr. Fink was the ATM, snow machine, etc., folks that are using, you know, handling those and having some violations dealing with that. The technology does exist to put an ignition interlock device on a snow machine or an ATV or any of those types of vehicles. And I know specifically in rural Alaska, you will have people who don't drive cars, but that's what they drive. But then you realize that we would have to be going back into the statute to redefine what a motor vehicle is. And then that brings up a whole other host of issues. And some of those issues were discussed previously before the bill was filed.
Christine, Representative Holmes has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Follow-up, that was very helpful. And to be specific on, I know he brought up the two issues. The one that I thought was the one that I was more interested in was the one of the, when you're driving under the influence, but it's drugs, using an ignition interlock on your car if you were pulled over because you were using Ambien seems like a sort of an expense without a purpose. So if we could find some language on those two lines that would accomplish it and give the court the discretion to not order an interlock only if the person were actually pulled over for something like Ambien or something, that might be of interest.
Mr. Chair, if I can ask a question, if someone is picked up for driving while under OxyContin or marijuana, are they charged as a DWI or how?
DUI.
Yes.
DUI.
Driving under the influence.
Under the influence.
So same as alcohol only.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Driving under the influence, I think, is rather than under the influence of alcohol, it's under the influence of a different stimulant.
Yeah.
We certainly have available to us Lieutenant Dial, the Department of Public Safety. We have Kerry Hennings from the DMV, and we have Doug Moody from the Public Defenders that are available to answer any questions. And this is the last committee referral, so although we're all showing some signs of fatigue, I would rather address this problem and move the bill out of committee in a just right fashion. We are scheduled to go on the floor at 5:00. It's important to me, Senator, to move this bill in a timely and prompt fashion. However, we would be very happy to recess to the call of the chair, have you do a little bit of work on this particular aspect, and to convene the committee at 4:45 and come back in and make an amendment or a change if we think this is necessary or helpful to the point of view that's been brought up, I think, by Jennifer Messick or by Josh Fink or by Representative Gruenberg, and move it out so that it's read across at our 5:00 session today and we don't lose a day. And I will leave that to your discretion. I'm going to take it brief at ease for a moment. We're back on the record. Senator Meyer, we appear to have drafted a conceptual amendment that will meet the needs that have been expressed. Are there any questions for the folks that have called in online? Are there any questions for Lieutenant Dial, Kerry Hennings, or Doug Moody's from the Troopers, Department of Motor Vehicles, or Public Defenders?
Yes,
anybody else in the room who wishes to testify? Stacy? Okay. Then we're gonna close public testimony. We will bring the bill back before the committee. I think Representative Holmes has a conceptual amendment to offer. Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to offer conceptual amendment number one, which on page 4, line 29, after the word device, we would add the words for alcohol-related offenses. And, Mr. Chairman, then on page 6, line 7, again after the word device, we would add the words for alcohol-related offenses.
Is there an objection? I'll object for the purposes of discussion. Representative Holmes?
Page 4, it's in page 6. Mr. Chairman, since it's a conceptual amendment, I'd appreciate you giving me the opportunity to explain why we're doing it. The intent of the conceptual amendment is that the court would not have discretion to suspend the requirement for an ignition interlock device if the person had been picked up on an alcohol-related DUI, but if the person had been driving under the influence of Ambien or something, for instance, the court could, in its discretion, forego the ignition interlock because, of course, there'd been no alcohol to begin with, and it might just be an unnecessary expense.
Are there other comments, Representative Gatto?
None, Mr. Chair.
Any comments from other members? I'm going to remove my objection to conceptual amendment number one. Seeing no objection, amendment number one passes. Are there any other amendments? I don't see any. Senator Meyer, are you satisfied?
I am indeed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Committee's Judiciary.
For the benefit of the Secretary, can you give her the thumbs up or thumbs down on changes that are made so far? Susan, if you'll please note a thumbs up from Christine on Senate Bill 239. The chair would entertain a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the House CS for Senate Bill 239 with conceptual amendments. And this is version 10C and attached fiscal notes with individual recommendations from committee.
Thank you. Seeing no objection, CS for Senate Bill 239, version C is in CAT, passes from committee. It's 2:45. We're adjourned.